This episode of What the Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Visit itpro.tv/what-the-tech and use the code WTT30 for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account. SendPro from Pitney Bowes. SendPro has 3 times the features of stamps.com at 1/3 of the price. Visit pb.com/GFQ to learn more and try it for free for 90 days. After that, you'll get SendPro for only $5 per month. That's pb.com/GFQ. And by Hover. Find a domain name for your idea. Go to hover.com/WTT and get 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's hover.com/WTT. Hover, domain names for your ideas. What the heck? Hey, buddy, welcome to What the Tech. I'm Andrew Zarin. Of course, I'm joined by the returning Paul Thorod. How you doing, Paul?
Pretty good.
I don't think we did a show for 2 weeks, you and I. Right?
Yeah.
I feel like it was forever.
Yep.
It could have been a week. It could have been 2 weeks. But a week without Paul feels like an eternity in my universe. How you doing, Paul?
You know, about the same as you, I think.
So you were traveling, obviously.
A little overwhelmed.
Right? You went to Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And then you came here, and then you went where? Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you went to Pennsylvania. So you've been very busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel?
I just want it to be over at this point.
You know? I know you pretty well, and you don't have a lot of patience for things like this.
Yeah. Moving is hard, you know, no matter how you do it, I guess. There are some things I mean, rather than just bitching and moaning, I should say, you know, we're lucky in one way because we're buying a family home. And so it's, you know, it's nice in some ways to be able to do this for, the woman who's basically my stepmother or whatever. Yeah. You know, but on the other hand, she's lived there for 25 years, but she also has, she has 25 years worth of clutter in the house.
That needs to leave.
Like a hoarder type of thing.
Yeah.
But she also has all of the stuff that came out of her parents' house when they died and her brother's house when he died years ago.
Oof.
And some of it is organized into bins, which makes it easy for me to throw in the trash because who gives a shit about this stuff anymore? No, I'm sorry. And some of it is not.
Yeah.
So it's we've spent a considerable amount of time, you know, just trying to get rid of that stuff.
And you got to work. And you got to do like 5,000 podcasts. And you got to write. And you got to travel.
Yeah. Like life doesn't just this doesn't take the time off.
Yeah, it doesn't say, right. Oh, Paul, you're moving? All right,
worry about it. Oh, are you busy, big guy? Oh, no, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
This doesn't work that way.
We do have a lot to get to since we're on the topic of getting stuff done. We do have a lot to talk about. I want to talk to you a little bit more about Windows 10S.
Okay.
And the reason why is that I feel like you and I never really spent some time on this. I had Brad on when it was initially announced, and you were traveling. And I feel like a good amount of time has passed, and I think we could reflect and go and discuss this a little bit more, because I've been getting asked a lot of questions, even just yesterday. I went to Rattle and Hum yesterday with John Prosser from Page Tech. And I don't know if you know John. He's a good guy.
That name is very familiar.
Yeah. He's a good dude.
He's working
on a very secret project for a very large company right now. So he's in New York for that. But we were discussing this, and somebody came over and to say hello. Said, I'm a big fan. Tell Paul and Mary Jo, I absolutely love them, and I love the podcast, and I love GFQ. And we started talking about Windows 10S.
Yeah, as one would.
Because this is a normal conversation to have at a bar at 10 o'clock at night. And it was just a very interesting discussion. I want to kind of, and I was thinking about it. I'm like, you know what? I haven't really put in a lot of thought into this, and it would be interesting for Paul and even the chat room to kind of throw us your questions about this, because it's very intriguing. So I have a bunch of questions for you, but before we go into this, I want to take a moment and talk about our new sponsor, and that's SendPro. I know a lot of us, me included, we're small business owners, and who has the time to go and search for rates between USPS and UPS? Nobody has time for that. Paul, you have no time for that. And it gets really complicated. It gets very hectic and complicated. SendPro is a one-stop shop. If you go to SendPro from Pitney Bowes, SendPro has three times the features that Stamps.com has at one-third of the price. If you go to pb.com/GFQ, you can learn more, and you can try it for free for 90 days. After that, they will. All you got to do is pay $5 per month. That's pb.com/GFQ. And here's a cool thing. You get this awesome scale to help you out when you're shipping stuff. It's a very high-quality scale. It's very nice. It's USB. It's powered. It's everything. And I've actually been using the scale because my wife does a lot of eBay stuff. She sells everything on eBay. All of her stuff that she no longer uses, all her clothing, all the kids' stuff, she'll sell it on eBay. And, you know, these things are small, light things, and you need to find out what the good shipping rate is, a very competitive shipping rate, and something that you can measure and ship for the right price. You don't want to say that it's more than it is, you know? Right. So my wife has been using this, and she absolutely loves it. They support USPS, UPS, and the other guys with an F. We're not allowed to mention them, by the way. The other guys, the other large shipping company, we are not allowed to mention them, but I have been told that we should talk about how we are not allowed to mention them. These guys are great. If you have Stamps.com, you know, Stamps.com is $15.99 a month. These guys, just $5. That's three times the features at one-third of the price. That's pb.com/GFQ. Go sign up there. I want to thank them for supporting the show. Who are those other guys, Paul?
I couldn't say.
Yeah. Not DHL. Like, I'll tell you, it's not DHL.
Right.
I don't know if anybody's used DHL. I actually got a package from DHL from China. They ship with DHL a lot. So I want to talk about Windows 10 S.
Okay. I can do that.
Because have you, number one, the Surface laptop, have you changed your thoughts on this?
Have I changed my thoughts?
Yeah.
I mean, I used it for a week. Yeah. Right. I like the hardware.
Okay.
I like the device. It's a good size. It's a nice form factor. It's high quality. I like the materials. I know there's some controversy around, you know, the Alcantara on the keyboard deck and whether it's going to last any, you know, amount of time or whatever. I don't know. It seems fine to me. I think it's a little expensive, but then all Surface devices are expensive. If you're serious about buying this for a college student and having it last the 4 years, you're going to want to get not the one that's the least expensive, right?
Yeah.
Because that's only 4 gigs of RAM, and I think it's 128 gigs of storage, which is not enough. Windows 10S is important, right, in the sense that it's important to Microsoft, and eventually it will be important to us. Today it doesn't solve the problem, and so, you know, the good news is if you buy this thing, you can upgrade to Pro for free.
Okay, so this has been my gripe with this, right? You're buying a premium device. And yeah. I know that you could upgrade, but I am very curious as to the number. I don't know how many they've sold of these already. Have they sold a lot?
There's no way to know.
The
early indication, though, is that they're selling pretty well.
Okay.
I say that based on the ad duplex, you know, usage data or whatever.
Yeah. But out of those people that are purchasing this, right, how many of them are how many of them are aware what kind of operating system they're getting, and how many of them are actually upgrading to Windows 10? That is the number that is very important here. Not so much if this device is selling, it's are people understanding what they're buying?
Right.
I hope I'm wrong when I say I really think people are going to buy this and they are using it and they have no idea they could upgrade to Windows 10.
So here's the thing. When you use it, it's not actually horrible the way they handle this, right? If you download Chrome as an obvious example, it will, from using Edge, it will allow you to download it. It doesn't prompt you or anything. But if you try to run that setup application, you'll get a very colorful and big prompt. It's not, you know, it's not something missable like you would see it.
You're not going to get the dung error message?
No, from Windows XP? You get an error. I mean, I put a picture of it in one of my articles, but it's just a, it's got colors and stuff. It's obvious. And it says, look, you know, you can't do this, blah, 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 blah. But if you, you know, you just click here and it does the upgrade. You do have to reboot the computer, but it's very fast. So it's a couple of minutes. And you're running Pro, and it looks exactly the same. Everything works exactly the same, except now you can run desktop apps. It's okay.
I'm willing to bet that most people are opting in for that.
I can't say all people, but let's say 99.99% of people have that one thing that they need, whatever it might be, and if they can't get it, that's the end of the story. So. Yeah.
Well, I mean, down to Chrome, right?
Chrome is the big one.
Yeah. You want to install Chrome or I mean, Skype, I guess you could use the...
I could almost get by just with Chrome, which, by the way, has led me down a kind of a different path where, you know, you think about these transitions that we make technologically. Microsoft wants to get rid of the Win32 code base because it's old and it's insecure and it has performance issues. You can take over the system and there's all these bad things with it. Yeah. The problem for Microsoft is that the Win32 subsystem is in Windows. It today is basically Windows. It's what people think of as Windows. It's, you know, what Chrome uses, what iTunes uses, what Spotify uses, what Visual Studio uses, what Hyper-V uses, what, you know, it's what Windows applications are written in. It's the file explorer that's built into Windows is Win32. So, you know, how do you get from here to there? So Microsoft has kind of put this, you know, line in the sand and you're either going to be running it or you're not. And I think what I'm trying to say is we need a happy medium here, you know, that during this transition period, we should be able to, on an app-by-app basis, say, look, I get it. I know that this is going to kill my reliability, maybe. It's going to kill my performance, maybe. But I just want to run this one thing. And you should be able to do that. And to me, that's a smarter customer-centric approach than what they're doing. And you know what? I bet they're going to get there because the truth is, this is one step toward that from Windows RT, right? Remember Windows RT, there was no way to upgrade, right? At least here now you can upgrade. I think the next version, they're going to say, okay. We can whitelist certain apps. It will warn you, you know, you're going to have these problems, whatever it might be. There are other technical solutions they could do. They could automatically wrap Win32 apps in some kind of a container, which is what these store apps are essentially anyway. Try to sandbox them and prevent them from hurting the system. You know, we'll see. But I think what's going to happen is this thing as it is now is not going to succeed, not in 2017.
Of course, yeah.
You know, they need to take an interim step.
I mean, we get what the feature of Windows is, right? It's these universal apps. It's that's their new platform. But, you know, I'm trying to think back at a moment where in modern times, the last decade, where we saw a major shift like this, right? Where it depended on apps. The platform success depending on apps. And, you know, it was a 10-year anniversary last week for the iPhone. And the success of that phone genuinely relied on the ecosystem that existed. And you could have had all these phones on the market that were, it could have been better than the iPhone. A lot of them weren't, but you could have come close. You could have been competitive. But the reality was, if the ecosystem wasn't developed, then people weren't going to use it. Microsoft has had an opportunity for quite a few years to really put effort and push developers to develop for this new app platform.
Yeah.
And it's gone terribly.
Right.
And
you could see steps in the direction you're talking about, which is just, you know, in the beginning it was like, let's do everything we can to get developers to bring the code they already have, whether it's on iOS or Android or in the web or in Win32 apps, and bring it into the UWP, the Windows Store world. But the thing is, you know, with legacy code bases, you know, mature applications, things like Adobe Photoshop or iTunes or Chrome even, none of those companies are ever going to rewrite those products for some new app platform. It doesn't make any sense. This thing already runs on 100% of the versions of Windows out in the world. Well, except for Windows 10S, which is like 0%. Why would we make a special version that only runs on one version? You know, it doesn't make any sense. And so I think the way that this transition has gone is that Microsoft has what they found is that developers in some cases will take advantage of these transitionary technologies and then they're done. You know, in other words, Adobe will take Photoshop elements, wrap it up in a Windows Store container and put it in the store. It's the Win32 app. There's nothing special about it. They're not going to ever update it again. You know, if they do release a new version of Adobe Photoshop's elements, which they probably will, yeah, it won't be a store app. It will be a desktop app, and then they'll contain that one and do the same thing again. You know, Evernote did this. Spotify did this. Apple is supposedly doing this with iTunes. This is just designed to get people to keep using the same app. No one's making a technological transition, right?
So these containers are probably going to be, next 10 years or 5 years, whatever the goal, the future is, right, for Microsoft. This is going to be the way to entice the developers to kind of bring their stuff in by doing these containers. To kind of run it. But that's a Band-Aid, right?
Well, it's a way to make the goal always is to get the user base and the developer base onto this new platform, right? But ultimately, you've got some audience. Let's say there's 1 billion people out there in the world and 500 million of them or whatever are running Windows 10. You know, 100% of those people can run a Win32 app right now. But what you want to do is get rid of the Win32 stuff that's in Windows. And so how do you do that? I mean, I don't actually think they're ever going to be able to do it, but I think the idea is like, well, let's just make it safer, you know, sandbox those apps in these containers.
Yeah.
In the beginning, you open it up, or what they've done so far is they open it up to developers. Like, in other words, Google would have to come to Microsoft and say, okay, we're going to do this for Chrome. Please allow us to put our app in the store. And of course, Microsoft would say yes. I think the future of this stuff is going to be more along the lines of, the operating system does it automatically, or you as a user will be able to do it. You know, I want to run Chrome. Well, okay, here's a little wizard you have to step through. Please understand that we can't control everything Chrome does, and your system might run slower because Chrome has its own updater, and that thing might have to run at boot up time. And if you do enough of those, your system might slow down over time and it might become less reliable. And you're like, yeah, I get it. I'm an adult. I just want to do what I want to do. Please stop, you know, putting these stupid rules in front of me. So, I mean, ultimately, I think that's where Windows goes. I don't think as much as it is sort of attractive to have this modern thing that we call Windows that has no legacy code in it or less legacy code, if we're going to be running Win32 apps in containers, which it would be safer and more reliable, well, we still need to have Win32 on the system. So
yeah.
I'm not really sure what the benefit is. Well,
how much of a, it's not just, you know, Adobe making an app and Google, you know, making an app. It's drivers. It's software that people, you know, a lot of these manufacturers, these driver manufacturers. I mean, look at, I could tell you, AMD themselves, they've had problems putting out a standard driver where it corrupts. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a new way to rethink this for everybody.
Yeah, there's a little issue I bet most people have never really considered, but if you just do something simple like plug in a printer, you know, for the first time, or a scanner or something, you're like, I want to print a photo. So you have Windows 10S and you plug the thing in, you will almost certainly get drivers that will work from the computer, you know, from the system. They're built in. So they're called inbox drivers. Actually, they're called like class drivers, I guess they call them. But what you're getting is basic capabilities. In other words, you have a color printer. You can probably print in color. You can probably print in black and white. You might be able to do a couple of things around deciding how big the photo is on the page or whatever.
You're not going to have all these options.
No, because all of the options are available in it's not really a driver, but it's a software application set that you get from the manufacturer that does include a driver, yes, but it also includes that interface that pops up that gives you all those crazy options. That application is a Win32 application, and you're not getting that on Windows 10S. So even in the case where things do work, they may not work as well as you are used to if you do rely on that software and expect it, or as well as they can work because you don't see what you're missing because you're just getting the basics.
Is there a time frame that Microsoft has kind of created for themselves to kind of get this thing rolling? I know this is the first, this is the second attempt if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
This is Windows RT again, but done in a different way, in a way better way. But do they have a time frame to kind of say like, okay, well, listen, we know people are going to be annoyed, and we know that people aren't going to adapt to this quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we hope to see, you know, 10% right. market share by 2020. You know
well,
what I mean? Like,
yeah. So they're not going to, right? Yeah. No, there's no, not at least not publicly, there isn't one. So the other thing to consider here is that a lot of people have mistakenly tied Windows 10S to the education market, to low-end computers, and to it being a Chromebook competitor. And for good reason, Microsoft presented it at an education event, and they talked about things that will remind people of Chromebooks. And sure enough, there are a lot of low-end computers running Windows 10S, or several of them. The problem for Microsoft for Windows 10 adoption, 10S adoption, is that there is no other decent computer running Windows 10S right now except for Surface Laptop. And when I talk to PC makers about this and I ask them, hey, what are you guys going to do? You know, and they're always very, you know, political about it. Like, well, you know, we like that Microsoft is making this attempt and blah, blah, blah. And basically what it boils down to is we're going to take a wait and see attitude. You know, we don't have any plans right now to put this on a, like if you were, I don't want to name names, but let's just pretend I had this conversation with HP. We're not going to make Windows 10S an option on our EliteBook X360, on our Spectre X360. Right now, you can only get it on whatever their educational thing. Dell, same thing. All the other PC makers, same thing. That's going to hamper adoption, right? But also, just the using it's going to hamper adoption because people are going to use it. They're going to try to run Chrome or whatever, and they're going to be like, oh, I guess I can get Pro for free. It doesn't cost anything. It doesn't hurt the computer. It takes 5 minutes. It tops. Easy.
I'm very curious about what the users of Windows 10S are thinking.
Well, first of all, I think that we're dealing with
I don't
user,
know any,
not
and
users.
I know none. And I know none. I mean, you're the only one that I know that has used it. And
Brad.
I don't know anybody with this device.
Nobody actually uses it. The truth is nobody uses it. And so I want to be clear, you know, it's not like I don't mean to say I'm down on Windows 10S. I actually appreciate what they're trying to do there. I'm just being realistic about it.
But is it realistic on this device? On a device that you're spending?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
And well, except, you know, there is a kind of, I don't mean to criticize people like this, but there is kind of a goonish subset of people out there who are kind of just Microsoft fans. And we're going to take anything Microsoft shovels down our throat. So these are the type of guys who are still looking for a new Windows phone in 2017 for some reason. Or
by the way, are we getting a new Windows phone?
No, but I mean, it's a little misguided, and they'll suffer because they're trying to do the arbitrary right thing, whatever that means, and they will use arguments like, well, this does everything that I need, to which I would reply, either to a Windows Phone user or to a Windows 10S user, you have no way of knowing that because it only does a little bit of things. You know, there may be some awesome stuff that you would need, but it's not even available to you. So how would you know? I guess, you know what it is? It's sort of like the difference between the theoretical and the real.
Yeah.
Theoretically, Windows 10S offers better performance, better reliability, better security, right? How much, we don't know, but some amount. In the real world, Windows 10 Pro or whatever runs the applications that most people think of as being Windows. So, you know.
Very interesting.
Just run the thing that works. You know, you got to run the thing that works.
Listen, you know what's fascinating to me? Majority of MacBook owners that I know, you know what they use as a browser? Safari.
Yeah.
Majority of Windows owners, you know what they use? PCs? They use Chrome.
Right. Right. That's because the browser options that we've had on the Windows side so far have been so terrible. You know, built into the OS. Yeah, I don't use a Mac every day. I have a Mac that I keep for testing purposes. You know, I do use an iPhone fairly regularly, and I have to say, on the mobile side, assuming you can get all your stuff over, like, and you can, you know, get your bookmarks synced, your passwords synced, whatever you want to do. Once you do that one time, it's not hard to use another browser on mobile. It's not hard to use another browser on Windows either. It's just that, you know, you just kind of want to get up and get work done. I really like it when I use Chrome on iOS and I go to some website and I haven't been there in a while and it auto completes my password.
Yeah.
You know, I love that. It's just really handy.
It makes life so much easier.
I will say, by the way, since you have an iPhone now,
yeah,
the next version of iOS has a feature in Safari where it can auto load the reading view for any article on the web instead of displaying what it looks like normally on the web. Meaning that if you went to CNN or my website and you were looking at the front page, you would see all the articles that were happening that day. But when you clicked on one or tapped it, the thing that comes up is that clean reading view.
Automatically or because
yeah, if you want it automatically.
Okay, because this has my iOS has it.
You have the ability to display it.
Display it, yeah.
What I'm saying is you can set a feature that will always display it.
Very nice. That's actually really good.
Now, that's a controversial thing, right? Because obviously these websites are relying on ads to earn the money to keep the website going. And so you could make the argument that it's kind of antagonistic to the sites, which in some ways it is. But from a user experience perspective, you're reading. You're here to read, you know. And the reading view thing in Safari is fantastic. So it might be reason to use Safari in the future.
Yeah. Very interesting. I do want to continue this discussion, but before we go on, I want to thank our sponsor, IT Pro TV. Opportunities in the tech industry are growing faster than any other job market. Just ask me. I had to go and get a job, and I had to rely on my experience in the tech world to get this job. There's no other time like the new year to start a new career in tech and move up the ladder. IT Pro TV offers you 2,000 hours of content, more than 30 hours added each and every week. You can stream these courses live or on demand worldwide in your Chrome browser, in Chromecast, on Roku, Fire TV, Apple TV, the PC, the Mac, whatever you want to do. Course topics include everything from ethical hacking to Windows Server to Photoshop and intro to JavaScript. These guys are unbelievable. You can sign up for a free membership if you go to itpro.tv/what-the-tech. The link is in our chat room and, of course, in our show notes. And you could use the code WTT30 for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, which is great. You can sign up for a free account, and that means that you get access to all their live shows that they do every single week, several courses for free also. With the live feed, you can view the course and begin while they're being recorded, and 30 hours of content each and every week. Standard membership gives you access to the entire library along with the live content. And there is a premium member level, which gives you all the benefits of the basic and the standard, but you also have access to over 100 step-by-step virtual labs, which are unbelievable. I really, really enjoy these guys because they not only do the tech side of it, they also do a lot of stuff like Photoshop and things like that, where if you're a creative type and you're looking to relearn or learn something that you weren't aware of, it's a great, great way to go and do this. IT Pro clients include Harvard, MIT, and Stanford, just to name a few. So it's unbelievable. It's a low monthly cost subscription and no hassle cancellation policy. I want to thank IT Pro for supporting the show. ITPro.tv. Use the offer code WTT30. Paul. Mm-hmm. Last week, we did almost an entire episode on the iPhone and how it changed everything.
Yeah.
And I did want to have this discussion with you because you and I have always been very much on the same page when it comes to mobile phones and how we use it. And our thing is whatever works for you, that's what you should use at the end of the day. Right. But I have, I'm an Android user for the most part since... I guess. Well, you know what's funny? I was a Trio user, then I was a Windows Mobile user, then I was an Android user, and this is my first iPhone. This phone right here. So it took me 10 years.
Because you're such a hater.
I'm such a hater, and I have to tell you.
Why don't you like nice things?
Why? I like to make my life as difficult as possible. I have to tell you, there is I get the appeal about Android, right? I really do. They make there's an appeal and there's a market, but the good enough mentality really wins over on this.
Also, I would call it the it just works mentality. It just works too, right?
It just works mentality.
Because you can screw around with Android all day long and maybe get something going that you couldn't be doing on iOS for sure. But man, there's a consistency to the performance and reliability of iOS that I find really appealing.
Well, 10 years in, right? We're looking in 10 years, so much has changed. I mean, they really defined the market.
Yep. Took them a while, though. That's the thing people forget, you know. When Apple first came out with the iPhone, everyone was blown away, and rightfully so.
Because it was pretty.
It was pretty. It did the stuff it did do was really impressive. Multi-touch capabilities had never really been seen like that on a tiny mobile device. You know, they were bringing the power of desktop Unix down to a phone, which was kind of crazy at the time. They brought applications and widgets from macOS 10 to the phone, which was kind of crazy at the time. They were showing the full web, which was kind of crazy at the time. But they also priced it out of the reach of all people. They didn't have an app store, right, which people kind of forget about. And, of course, this is not Apple's fault, but in the early days, the iPhone was limited. You had to connect it to your PC before you could even use it. You couldn't activate the phone by itself.
You had to connect it to iTunes.
You had to connect it to iTunes. So that means that if you stood in line on day one for the first iPhone like I did, and Apple handed you the phone, which they did, you couldn't call anybody from the store or do anything. Well, you could probably connect to Wi-Fi. Well, I don't think you could even do that. But you could make phone calls. You had to go home and activate it through iTunes. So there was a lot of that. It was also woefully incomplete. You know, there were a lot of legitimate complaints, and I made a bunch of them about its lack of compatibility with the Microsoft work-related technologies of the day, and so on. And so, you know, they fixed all that stuff. But, you know, people, you know, because we have this kind of history rewriting need, you know, whatever it is, you know, the original iPhone failed. I mean, it came out of the gate and fell flat. It was just like the original Macintosh. It was exactly the same thing. And it was, I think, Steve Jobs and Apple's experiences with that first Macintosh that saved the day, because they didn't just let it rot like Apple did with the first Mac. They dropped the price significantly, and they worked really hard to fix all the things that were wrong with it.
Well, it didn't do well. Why? Because of the pricing.
Well, and also it wasn't actually compatible with any of the like messaging systems that people use. So if you had Exchange at work, which everyone did, it didn't work with that.
Yeah.
It was incomplete. So by year two, they had fixed all that stuff. In fact, one of the big slides from the second iPhone announcement and what they were still calling iPhone OS at the time was Exchange ActiveSync. You know, they went right down the list. They put all that stuff in there. They fixed that, and they moved very quickly to do that. Of course, the App Store was huge.
I mean, if you think about it, the original conception of this device, right, mm-hmm. was 2005.
Yeah, and also remember, too, it was only on AT&T and only in the United States at launch.
The concept, really, I mean, you're going back. It took them a couple of years to develop this thing. So if you're going back, you're thinking 2005.
Terrible networking. Remember 2.5G networking on Edge.
Well, it wasn't until the iPhone 3G that really changed everything. That's what it was. It was the iPhone 3G.
Well, yeah, they fixed the problems at 1.0.
Yeah.
They expanded the availability worldwide. They started doing it. Of course, over the next few years, that got bigger and bigger. And they opened it up to third-party developers. Remember, the original app developer store was you could create web apps. In those days, it was 10 years ago, like that wasn't going to fly.
Yeah.
Today, you could probably make that work, honestly, with progressive web apps. But back then, that wasn't going to work.
It's amazing to me how, you know, all I could think of is from that time, because I held off for so long, right?
Yeah. yep.
All I remember is the iPhone killer headlines. The iPhone killer.
Of course.
This is the iPhone killer. This is the iPhone killer. Yep. And it never came. It never showed up.
No, I mean, there were big phones. I mean, I can't remember too many of them, to be honest. But one of the big ones, remember, was the original Motorola Droid, which my wife surprised me by getting, which was marketed in a very masculine way. It was all about power and you know, it was a lot of, you know, thumping steel in the ads and stuff. Like, it was, you know, this was the big boy phone. I'm trying to think of any other big phones. I guess not. I mean, there were attempts. There were things like the Palm. What was the Web OS phone? Palm. Jeez, I'm losing it. Whatever that Palm thing was, it was an attempt. Microsoft tried with two generations of Windows Mobile, Windows Phone, whatever. BlackBerry.
Yeah.
Storm.
Yeah, yeah, the Storm. BlackBerry. Oh my God. Yeah, that was it.
Tried Touch and didn't work the first time.
Well, the Storm was terrible. Storm 2 was kind of better, right?
Honestly, in some ways, the most interesting story about the iPhone is the reaction the other phone makers had to this device. You know, Motorola, RIM, BlackBerry, RIM at the time, Nokia, Palm. You know, all these companies reacted like, you know, that this was not going to be a problem. I should be fair to Palm. Actually, Palm reacted correctly because Palm was run at that time.
They had no money. They ran out of money.
Yeah. They were run by, I can't forget his name because I'm losing my mind right now. But the guy, he was the guy who was at Apple, previously worked on the iPod. Yeah. His name was,
I can't remember either.
Whoever he was, but he was pretty good and they ran out of money. And then the other company that responded very quickly was Google, right?
Yeah.
Remember that Google was, either Android by itself or Google had bought Android or however that worked, that the timing by the time the iPhone came out was Android was at Google. You know, the Android phone was going to be very different. And they saw the iPhone and Andy Rubin said, okay, stop everything. We're changing this.
What was it supposed to be like? I don't remember what the...
I think it was like a... There was a... not a keyboard, but like a number pad. And it was like the, you know, like a candy bar type phone where you could type on it by, you know, hitting each key multiple times to do different letters.
Yes. That's it.
And, you know, a lot of the other phone makers to one degree or another, like companies like RIM, which really relied on the keyboard, thought the keyboard was their big asset, or companies like Microsoft where they had partners that made phone, or some Android phone makers. In fact, that first Droid had a slide out keyboard. Remember, there was a lot of hedging of bets because people thought the touch keyboard on the iPhone wasn't going to be good enough.
Yeah.
And what we've discovered over time is that it was. I remember, I probably told you the story already, but years and years ago, after the iPad had come out, the first iPad, I was staying with a friend up in Seattle area, and his wife was watching TV, and she had the iPad out in front of her on a table on the little stand, you know, that you make with the cover. So it's kind of tilted up at an angle. And she's tapping away on the screen like a touch typist, like on the glass. And I was like, what are you doing? And she says, I'm responding to an email. But she was typing like I type.
Like you type on a keyboard.
And that was the moment I realized, you know, I may never be able to do that. I still can't type accurately on a phone. I have horrific typing problems on a phone for whatever reason. In fact, it's funny, my original iPhone review, I actually comment on how my fingers always seem to be off to the wrong side of the letter I'm trying to type. And autocorrect will catch it sometimes, but it won't some other times. Anyway, but she obviously didn't have this problem. And she was typing fast, you know, and I thought, geez, it's over. I mean, this is, if you can do that, yeah, this other stuff is all going away.
I'm looking at, you know what it was? It was the G1, right? The one that came out.
The original Nexus.
The original, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. You know what I remember from that phone? The stupid knob.
Mm. It was a mouse cursor, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't it a wheel?
It was a wheel.
Am I thinking the
right thing? I think so. It was like a weird knob.
I know there were palms that did that, but I think it literally was a little ball.
Yeah, it was a ball, but it wasn't a mouse. It was just you know, select.
Oh, for selecting things.
Yeah.
The stupid clock.
All those widget clock.
Yeah, that was on Android for a long time, actually. Remember in the early days, Google pretended to respect Apple's patents, which frankly, most of them were invalid anyway. But, you know, Apple, Steve Jobs stated at that day, like, we invented multi-touch. It's like, dude, you were like 12th in line. Nobody at Apple invented multi-touch. But anyway, yeah. Google, the first few versions of Android, the first few phones, didn't offer some of the multi-touch gestures that were on the iPhone. So things like pinch to zoom and so forth. That's why the Maps app had like plus and minus signs on the side so you could zoom in and then move the screen around. Like on Apple,
you kind of
pinch and just go. And then over time, Google started slipping those things in. And then eventually Apple started suing. Not Google, which is interesting when you think about it, but they started suing the phone makers.
It's amazing to me how a lot of this changed so quickly, so rapidly.
Yeah.
And then people wonder how was Apple able to create the iPad? You know, it was because they found something that really worked that nobody else was able to do.
Yeah, I mean, Apple, you know, is a fast follower, I guess is the phrase, or what, you know, they don't usually invent anything, but they do have a nice way of looking at the germ of an idea and saying, hey, we could turn that into something really sweet. And in the case of the iPad, they were working on the iPad before the iPhone, but the iPhone, for whatever reason, made more sense to do first.
Yeah.
So going to the iPad from the iPhone was, and you know, making the iPod Touch as well, was a very simple process. It's like, let's do this, but we'll make it bigger. Yeah. You know, and they did, you know, they did a pretty good job with it for what it is. But that's a different story. But
it's such an interesting conversation to look back on, and yeah. There was so many missed opportunities. And this is kind of my point here. Microsoft was in the game way before Apple was with this, and every manufacturer, every Palm and every OEM, you know, everybody had a Windows mobile phone. Yep. It's interesting to me that Microsoft didn't say, you know what, we need a new radical design, or HTC, you know, said we need a new radical design to the phone, because not only was the operating system, the software, yeah, that was a major point here, but it was also aesthetically very different than anything else on the market. And right. Still to this day, the legacy of that original iPhone is in every single phone, because this concept of a phone like this changed along with it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that nobody else went that direction.
You know, I mean, a lot of this stuff is just kind of weird historical anomaly stuff. So one thing people have probably forgotten is that Apple made the original Mac in the early 1980s. They based the design of what they did largely on what they saw at Xerox PARC, right? There's some interesting innovations in the original Mac, because the guys from the Mac team that saw the stuff at Xerox PARC thought that that computer did stuff it wasn't doing. So they invented it for the Mac, not realizing they were the first ones to do it.
Yeah.
You know, the ability to, you know, move windows over each other, for example. Like, it was something that they had actually not figured out at Xerox. Steve Jobs, for whatever reason, and this dates back to 1981, 82, somewhere in that time frame, was talking to Bill Atkinson. I think the guy's name is the guy who did like the graphics primitives on the original Mac. And he wanted rounded rectangles to be one of the graphics primitives, like primitives, things like squares, lines, circles, ovals, that kind of thing. And Bill Atkinson said that would be almost impossible to do, and it would take a lot of CPU resources and drawing. Why would you want to do this? There are no rounded rectangles in the world. We don't need this. And so he started pointing out every place in the room where there were rounded rectangles. They went for a walk outside. There were rounded rectangles. Yeah. There were street signs around, you know. And so he said, fine, whatever, you know. So it's interesting when you push forward, you know, whatever that is, 30 years, the iPhone is a rounded rectangle. You know,
yeah.
And if you look at the icons, they're rounded rectangles. They're rounded squares, but they're, you know, one of the things that, I mean, it's weird, right? This one strange design element that Steve Jobs was a big fan of is still the key
to all this, yeah.
Of
to
the
PCs.
iPhone.
I mean, PCs now too.
Yeah.
Rounded rectangle. Yeah, right? Everything is round.
Well, the windows on the Mac OS are rounded rectangles. It's interesting, you know. It's a goofy little thing, but it's a thing that has just, you know, it's one of their things. And so, you know, in the 1980s and into the 90s, Microsoft made Windows. Apple threatened to, and then ultimately did sue Microsoft because they felt they copied the design of the Mac. Apple lost in court consistently, and what the courts found in that case repeatedly was that protecting the design of something as intellectual property is actually really hard. Like, you can typically patent like a process for doing a thing, but patenting a design is a little more nebulous, although actually that's a lot more common today than it was back then. Anyway, Apple lost that case. And when you flash forward to the 2010s, whatever it is, Apple has or had, probably still has, lawsuits against various phone makers, especially Samsung.
Based on
the design, yeah. Right? And if you look at the Samsung phones that came out in the wake of the iPhone, they, sure enough, I mean, they look just like the iPhone. There's no doubt about it. Actually, Apple's done a better job of protecting the design of its products more recently than it did, say, in the 1990s or whenever that was.
They, and I don't they, know they, why. They leak, but, they'll leak the information themselves, though.
Well, I mean, in court, like in court, other words, yeah, yeah. But as you said, if you go into a store and look at any, like the Google Pixel is it's an iPhone ripoff, right? We all accept that, don't we? I mean, it is literally,
aren't they all, at this point, it's become such a blend, right? All these phones kind of look alike. And now with the next generation iPhone, it's going to look like the Samsung phones.
But that's the thing. So in other words, okay, but I think these things are actually tied together. You were saying earlier, and you were right, why weren't the phone makers of the day innovating with touch screens and blah, 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 whatever? Because they were just doing things the way they did, you know, whatever, who knows why. Yeah, I think sometimes it takes a company that doesn't have a stake, that's scrappy and needs a hit to, you know, to make things happen. So Apple happened, the iPhone happened, everyone copies the iPhone. Well, here we are, it's 10 years later.
Yeah.
Samsung certainly has copied Apple a lot. I think we've established that. But it's really interesting that Samsung, and not some tiny company no one has ever heard of, has, again, not in a necessarily a major, major way, but in a fairly significant way, taken the screen, done the wraparound thing first, right? Talk about the ultimate rounded rectangle, actually round the screen. And now they've changed the form factor so that it's like a 19 by 9 or 18.5 by 9, whatever it is. And what you get is a device where they describe it as 6 inches tall, and you think, wow, this thing's going to be ginormous.
It's not.
But then you hold it in your hand, and you're like, wow, actually, this is really nice.
Yeah. I spent some time with it yesterday. I was playing around with the S8.
It's great,
The Plus, the big one.
Yeah. And it's not that big.
It's not that big. And
it's really wonderful.
It's actually slightly bigger than... Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh, geez, careful.
Well, I already... My daughter took this thing and just slammed it and cracked it today. It's a little bit bigger than this. Slightly bigger than this.
But it does that thing that Apple talked about doing. I think it was the iPhone 5, where you can hold it in one hand and actually use it because it's not that thick or wide, I guess, across the middle, right?
Yeah, I feel like that's the problem with this phone.
Yeah,
you know, that's the problem with all these big phones. It's too big. My hands just don't wrap around.
I have enormous hands, and I can't reach the other side of the screen.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know, I'm looking here. It took almost 2.5 years for the for companies to get competitive with the iPhone.
Yeah.
That's why they...
How long did it take for someone to come up with a competitor to the Google Echo? The Amazon Echo.
Probably 2 years.
Yeah, see? It's interesting, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're supposedly in this fast-moving era of constant innovation. And somebody drops an asteroid on the Earth, and it takes a long time to respond.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a little.
I think it's people are stuck in their own. You know, we do things a certain way. You know, and I think
roadmap.
It's hard to turn around the ship.
Look at BlackBerry; they stuck to a 10-year plan.
I know,
and they're still making BlackBerry classics.
Well, but you know, BlackBerry is like Polaroid today in a way. You know, they're kind of outsourcing everything. It's
I see people still using it.
Jeez.
Still using BlackBerries.
Yeah, I don't ever see BlackBerries anymore.
Hanging on, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting discussion to have 10 years later, you know, and how much of the computer market has changed.
Right.
I'd like to look back and I would like to look back further, you know, not just with the iPhone, but I think it's such an important part of how we use technology as a society. All of us.
Yep.
It's a major, major change, and you know, the next 10 years, it's going to shoot lasers, Paul. That's it. It'll have wings.
I made this.
Grab onto it. It'll fly us.
Yeah.
Fly us away. I do have one more topic, but I do want to thank one more sponsor, and that is, let me, if I could pull it up here, that'd be wonderful, Andrew. Hover.com, domain names made simply and easily and hassle-free. If you go to hover.com/WTT, you get 10% off your first purchase. You could purchase any of these, the regular .com, .co, .net, or you could do these crazy URLs like .pizza and .ninja. I want there to be a throt.pizza and just Paul's head on a
Peter,
and call it Brad.
Peter should
on
have the domain doctor.pizza.
Doctor.pizza. I wonder someone must have that.
I bet.
Someone must have doctor.pizza. You could buy all these domains and get 10% off at hover.com. No. They don't do upselling. Private registration is included. So, you know, if someone looks up the Whois search, your name does not come up and your address does not come up, which is a good thing. These guys are great. Great customer service. Literally takes minutes. And they do a great job at transferring your domain names. If you have domain names somewhere else, you could transfer it in to Hover, and it's hassle-free. Hover.com/WTT. I want to thank them for supporting the show. You know, I do want to... 10 years ago, what was the PC market like?
10 years ago?
Yeah. When the iPhone dropped. All right, we're going back to 2007. Yeah, I mean,
so we had just, you know, the iPhone was the kind of the end of the PC era in a way. And so when you think about, you know, Windows Vista had come out in 2006, 2007. I'm trying to remember what the, I mean, those, they were just pretty standard looking PCs. I mean, this is post, I would imagine the core processors had happened, you know, but during the development of what became Windows Vista, Microsoft and its partners were showing off all these kind of advanced futuristic designs, none of which came to pass. I was just reminiscing about this with Mary Jo, that there were secondary displays they were talking about building into the outside of the laptop lid. So you could see, like, if you had, like, unread emails or whatever.
It would kind of
notify in the outside.
I remember that.
You know, tablet PCs were still... Actually, you know, with Windows Vista, tablet PC got rolled into PC. And so the interesting thing about that is that way back in 2002, Microsoft released the first version of Windows with tablet PC capabilities as we know them today. But they were for pen, not for touch, right? And if they added touch over time, but if it was touch, it was like single touch. It was just like a touch thing. And eventually multi-touch capabilities were, of course, added. Media Center was still a thing, but Media Center PCs, you know, not very common, but there were a couple of designs that looked like stereo components. Netbooks were absolutely a thing, or were becoming, actually it was Windows Vista, because Microsoft's response to the netbook was to make Windows XP Starter Edition, even though Windows Vista was a thing.
Yeah. I remember I went and got a terrible Lenovo netbook.
Yeah, I got one. I got a Toshiba that was, you know, for what it was. It was whatever. But, I mean, today would be sad.
Unusable.
It was sad then, I mean, honestly. But I don't know. They were pretty pedestrian looking. You know, we didn't have Ultrabooks yet. The Ultrabook came after the MacBook Air, and I don't know the first MacBook Air, but I have in my head the year 2010 for some reason.
That's probably true.
And I don't remember if that's the one that everyone has today, you know, because they really haven't changed it, or if it was the very first one, but that was later. And that's something Apple used to talk about. Remember, they obviously iOS, as it came to be called, had all this technology in it for Mac OS X at the time. But then you get this kind of virtuous cycle that can occur. And so design elements from iOS can go back to Mac OS.
2008 was the original.
Yeah, but the original didn't sell. The one we all kind of think of today as the MacBook Air. The
2010 version, yeah.
That's what I thought. I'm not sure, but I think so. But I bet part of the design of the MacBook Air, part of that was them sort of feeling out, like, what's the future of computers look like? Like, how do we make computers that are more like these mobile devices? And, of course, you go in the same kind of direction, which is like thin, 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 light, light, light. You know, what does that look like? And so, you know, the MacBook Air is kind of a classic now because it's the model for all what we call ultrabooks. You know,
it was so thin. This thing was super thin still.
Yeah, no, it's still nice. I mean, all they'd have to do is put a high-res screen in there. I'd be happy to keep using it.
Yeah, call it a day. And I don't know why they don't do that. They have an i7 version. I don't know why they don't do it.
It's like terrible resolution. I think it's like 1400 by 1900.
I don't think it's ever changed.
It's terrible. You can't do display scaling with it because it's just – there's no scaling.
No.
So you're kind of left out of a lot of the stuff that's Mac OS.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's weird.
Very weird. Guys, go to our website, gfknetwork.com. You can follow Paul at therot.com. Everything Paul is on there. He does a great job each and every day. He does a podcast with Brad on there. You can sign up and become a The Rot Premium member. Give him a couple bucks, and you get all these great articles that we always reference here on the show. It's my first site that I go to now in the mornings.
Me too.
It's that, and I go to the wrestling subreddit.
Oh, I don't go to that.
That's my day. That's my
day. Our days diverge.
It's about 9 o'clock. Our day totally shifts. you could go there. You could subscribe there. Also, subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/whatthetech. You can fund us there. We do bonus shows. Do you have time to do anything today?
I have a meeting at 3. Jeez, I skipped out of that last week too.
These meetings are killing me. It's all right. We'll do one next week. maybe we can move the show to like 1.
Thursday, maybe. I'm going to be in Pennsylvania next week.
Okay. So no show next week?
No, I should be able to do it.
Good.
On Thursday, I'm getting the cable modem installed, and I'm going to put in this Google Home networking thing.
Cool.
So maybe I'll be able to do it from the new house.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That'd be interesting.
Season debut of the new location.
You never know.
Yeah. Follow Paul on Twitter @TheRot. You can follow me @AndrewZarian. And that's it for this week. Take care.